June 24th, 1986. June 25th, 1986, William Burroughs at Kappa Sigma, Naropa Institute Summer Writing Program.
Okay. Good. The subject I will address, first subject I will address, is of interest to young and old, man and beast, to everyone without exception. It's the subject is the technology of wishing. How to formulate your wish in such a way that it has some chance of being realized. And a consideration with less popular appeal, the responsibilities involved in wishing, you might say the ethics of wishing. My own interest in the subject was rekindled when this book came to my attention. Now it's called On the Frontiers of Science by G. Harry Steen and published by Athenaeum Press in New York. The book was given me by one Len Magruder, who has now founded the Magruder Foundation to investigate subjects on the frontiers of science. He's a retired psychology professor with a keen interest in gambling systems, among other things. Gambling does not interest me in the slightest. Nothing costs more than what you don't pay for. You want to win like Nick the Greek? The price is you will become Nick the Greek. I don't want to do that. Well, now here in this book is something called The Wishing Machine, Chapter 9. First, there's a brief description as to how this device is made. It's pretty simple, looks like. Here we are. When a symbolic sample, a photograph of a plant or person, for example, or it could be a hair, lock of hair, fingernail peelings, anything. This is pure sympathetic magic. Then you put it between the two copper input plates and the amplifiers turned on, the experimenter then consciously thinks of some change he desires to occur in. The symbol in the sample place between the plates. According to private correspondence with John W. Campbell, Jr., this device achieved a 90% plus kill rate ratio for Japanese beetles. In 90 test plots, achieved a 70% kill against corn borers in other tests, destroyed tent caterpillars, all but eliminated acne from the skin of his adolescent daughter, eliminated a number of severe warts on an infant girl. And here is the author's experience. It seems that his little girl was suffering from very severe warts. It had a number of medical treatments which were unavailing. So I placed a photograph of my daughter between the input plates of my wishing machine, turned on the battery power, and consciously thought about those warts going away, about killing the virus that was causing the warts, and about my daughter without them. So we left it on. The result was frightening. Within 3 days, my daughter's warts had decreased markedly, including those that were beginning to grow inside her nostrils. Within 4 weeks, she was free of warts and has not had anything like them since. I disassembled my wishing machine because I was afraid of what I might do with it. It seemed that this phenomenon involved too much personal power of a sort I didn't understand and felt that I might not be able to control. The machine was also sheer outright magic, whose consequences went far beyond that of strange machines such as the dowsing rods or some other he describes in here. Yes. Oh, this one. Okay. Well, so, in other words, he just couldn't handle it. Well, Wisher should be made of sterner stuff. It works, so he's gonna disassemble it, for Christ's sakes. Then he says that this is not a murder machine, that it seems to be only useful against fairly simple living organisms. Well, I say if it'll kill a corn borer, it could kill a person. I mean, it really is potentially a killing machine. Well, anyway, Magruder had one of these machines made up and gave it to me for experimental purposes. And well, I had some success. Well, wait a minute. Here are a few of the if you're going to make a wish, there are certain rules. And one of the best was formulated by Eliphas Levi. Vouloir sans désirer, voilà le secret de le pouvoir. To wish or will without desiring. Always visualize your wish is already accomplished. All wishes must be unconditional. I mean, if you're going to say, yeah, I want it, but forget it. It's dead on the launching platform. And then, since your wish is unconditional, a question of responsibility arises. Ask yourself what would be necessary to realize your wish. How many of you have read The Monkey's Paw? I was hoping for more than that. Well, this is a perfect example. It's one of the best stories on the three wishes, I think. In the language. Well, the story is this couple living there with their son, very respectable, staid people, and an old sailor friend comes in, and he has this monkey's paw with him. And three people will have three wishes granted, and this was, magic was put into the monkey's paw by an old fakir to show that people shouldn't interfere with fate, that their wishes will bring them nothing but unhappiness. Well, so the old sailor, he's had his three wishes, and he throws it in the fire, and the host goes and picks it out. he said, I threw it on the fire. If you keep it, don't blame me for what happens. Pitch it on the fire again like a sensible man, and of course he won't. Okay, so he makes about one of the stupidest wishes you could possibly make. Ask for money. Oh boy. Well, says it seems that I have all I want. If you cleared the house, you'd be quite happy, wouldn't you? Said Herbert, that's the son. Well, wish for 200 pounds. Then that'll just do it. Well, he did. I wish for 200 pounds, said the old man distinctly, holding the monkey's paw in his hand. A shuddering cry from the old man. It moved, he cried with a glance of disgust at the object. As I wished, it twisted in my hands like a snake. Oh well, you just imagined it, dearie. Okay, now, next day, a man comes around to call. Brother, a mysterious stranger, and he's obviously very ill at ease. I was asked to call, he said at last, and stooped to pick up a piece of cotton from his trousers. I came from Ma and Megan's. That's the factory where the son works. The old lady started. Is anything the matter? Has anything happened to Herbert? What is it? Yes. Is he hurt? Demanded the mother wildly. The visitor bowed his head in assent. Badly hurt, he said quietly. But he is not in any pain. Oh, thank God. Thank God. Thank... Caught in the machinery. He was the only one left to us, he said, turning gently to the visitor. It is hard. The other coughed. The firm wish me to convey their sincere sympathy with you and your great loss, he said. I beg that you will understand I am only their servant. The factory Ma and Ma disclaim all responsibility. They admit no liability at all, but in consideration of your son's services, they wish to present you with a certain sum as compensation. That's the first wish. A couple of days later, she gets an idea. Walt. She's gonna, see, she gets the monkey's paw. She's gonna wish her son back to life. So, then there's a loud knock resounded through the house. It's Herbert, she screamed. It's Herbert. What are you going to do? It's my boy, and she's going down, of course, to open the door. For God's sakes, don't let it in. It was in a terrible state, you understand. I didn't want to tell you this, but my God, don't let that thing in here. So, anyway, she's struggling with the bolt. Her husband was on his hands and knees, groping wildly on the floor in search of the paw. If he could only find it before the thing got in. Well, he heard the chair drawn back and the door opened. A cold wind rushed up the staircase, a long, loud wail of disappointment and misery from his wife. The street lamps flickered on a quiet and deserted road. Very good handling of the three wishes. Well, now, that story, if I ever again have to teach a class in creative writing, I would certainly assign that, because there are any number of stories that can be written on that subject of the monkey's paw, the wish.
Wish thing.
There's almost no wish that you can make which isn't very, very dubious indeed. So, with these considerations in mind, I tried the machine. And being a beginner's luck, first one was Magruder himself suffers from, I think you call it kinetitis, ringing in the ears. Well, it can be. I think about there are about 10 million people in America who have this condition. And it can be an absolute torment. I mean, driving people to suicide, they feel like they've got freight trains going through their head. And apparently there's nothing that the medical profession can do about it, but they're working on it. Well, it occurred to me right away that a good idea would be this, that he record the closest approximation of this ringing on a tape recorder, and then start slowing it up, running it backwards, getting control of it. In other words, getting it outside himself, and then slowly dampening it down. Well, he started to do this, and I also used the wishing machine. But at the very time that we synchronized it later, that I was using the machine, he did have a dramatic improvement in his condition, which has continued to this day, I'm glad to say. Not completely gone, but considerably alleviated. I think the tape, well, we don't know whether it was the tapes or the machine or whatever, possibly both, I don't know. And then also there's a growth on my cat's lower lip. One of the cats has a growth on its lower lip. Surgery on the lip, of course, is very difficult because the cat will eat. And it's very difficult for the surgery on the lip to heal. Well, I had some considerable success there. That is, it's gone down to the point where we don't need surgery, according to the vet. No luck in getting a lost cat back. And no luck with a friend's emphysema. Well, of course, you got, you know, so many good ones and so many bad ones. I don't know anything about electronics or to what extent this device could be improved, or maybe someone could find just a simple little circuit, something that they could patent. As it is, you've got nothing you can patent. And that would really make it a little more than just, you know, well, so many good ones and so many bad ones. And there would certainly be a fortune in that. I mean, the title alone, the wishing machine, that's a real winner. As I say, there's so many different stories that you could write on that, on the subject of the wishing machine. Let's see, well, mister, I don't say it works, but I know the man cleared the acne off his daughter's ugly face. Nobody seen just how ugly it was till he cleared the acne off, and maybe he shouldn't have done it like that. Then he wished the hemorrhoids of his grandmother to recede. Before there was night crawlers, now there's like those little red worms you play shit threading on your hook. Another bloke killed with a tapeworm and his maiden aunt, and her gained 10 pounds in 1 week. Well, do anything positive like bringing back a lost cat. He's looking for a lost cat, too. Well, I don't rightly know, but I figure with this artifact, the sky might not be the limit. All is in the knockdown, the diffidence that faltered. How's that? Ezra Pell. Tell Ezra to pull down his vanity. And bear in mind that this is a murder machine. And this you gotta hear. Man wished his neighbor dead, neighbor went full crazy and come after the wizard with a chainsaw. Cut him in two sections, like the lady saw it in Half Act. Difference being the wizard was in no condition to take the bow. And then the neighbor dropped dead from the fun of it. So think before you wish out some rotten weed wish. The gods of chance don't like whiners, welchers, and pikers. Feed a whiny wish through this machine, and you will soon have ample cause to whine. And from half-assed wishers shall be taken even that which they have. I only want one thing. In that case, you'll likely get it one way or another. So he wishes, makes an unconditional wish for a smoker's return, regardless of any consequences. Knowing that the fulfillment of his wish might occasion an earthquake or a winter tornado might even rip the known universe apart. In other words, you've got to be able to take those chances if you're gonna use this machine. The title, you didn't say it, but I'm sure it comes from that old story, you know. You take something that a monkey likes, like almonds or raisins, and put it in a coconut or a box with a hole just big enough in the monkey's paw. And he reaches in there and grabs a handful of these, whatever it is, and he can't get his hand back out, and he's too dumb to let go of what he's got, you know, just like Homo sap. Yeah. Well, Oh, you can turn up the story material anywhere. Oh, well, some more on this variations on the monkey paw. Someone makes a simple wish. I just want to do my job better than anybody has ever done it before. Oh, boy, is he in for trouble. So the wish is a cop. At first when he starts cracking cases, everybody likes it, and he gets promoted. But, well, if he goes on, and boy, they just want to be rid of him. It doesn't pay to get too good at anything. And so forth. Someone wants to write a great book, but it is so great nobody can stand to read it. So, whatever you wish for, and of course, some people naturally would wish for some gift, like second sight. That's a very common wish. Well, that's got a lot more sense than trying to wish for money. That's about the worst thing you can wish for, something solid and three-dimensional like money. I haven't seen any stories. This would be another good exercise for a class on the Tylenol Excedrin killer. Oh, yeah, trying to get into his mind. Well, obviously the guy's got something about painkillers, because both of them, you see, there was extra strength Tylenol and what is it? Extra strength Excedrin. Yeah. So. I don't know what is in his mind, whether he disapproves of painkillers or what. He's got something on painkillers. One on that. Here are two little incidents picked up from the paper. Someone who recognized his death and then insisted on being killed by an unwise physical attack on his own instrument of death. just about silly a thing as a man could do. Well, this man got drunk and was swimming in a slough in Florida when he saw two alligators. In a frenzy of rage, he attacked the alligators, screaming obscenities. And the alligators dragged him under the water and drowned him. Of course, nobody did anything about it. They said he got what was coming to him. Now, the other young man got on a bus, muttering imprecations, and there was an old 85-year-old man sitting there. And he looked at him and said, "You!" And pulled the old man from his seat and threw him to the floor. And the old man said, "You don't know who you're messing around with." So then the old man pulled a .25 automatic from his raincoat pocket and fired three shots, killing the youth instantly. He was acquitted. Now, this is a point I've made many times before in my talks here at Naropa. But I know that it's happened to me many times that someone had to tell me something 10 times before I finally heard it. This is just a simple observation on the way human perception actually functions. Everything you see has a special meaning for you because you see it. Seems obvious, but in practice it comes as a shock to many people. And people have been brain damaged by the scientific dogma that there is no relation between human consciousness and so-called external reality. So I just always gave this exercise to my students, and I'll get to it here in a moment. So the scientific mentality is quite as dogmatic as the old devil snatchers of the Inquisition, One side has said anyone writing or publishing anything on a so-called ESP and flying saucer should be publicly horsewhipped and refrain from further activity. And another said he would not believe in ESP no matter what evidence was offered. What is the basic dogma of science? It is very simple and quite indefensible that the underlying dogma is quite simple. Human consciousness must never be allowed to influence physical processes or other consciousnesses. Well, to me, this is an absolutely indefensible position, invalidated by simple observation on the part of anyone who keeps his eyes and his mind open. Here's a quote from the New York Times. No one can seriously maintain at the present time that the rites of a shaman could influence the weather. Well, only those who have seen it done or done it. I've seen it, and I've seen wells witched out and all that sort of thing. It's a question of clicking in. But we can see the same process in operation all around us, round the clock. Just make a habit of noting what you are thinking and feeling when you encounter an intersection point that caught your attention. It could be words on a passing truck, an advertisement, or a person. Didn't I see him before in the deli in the drugstore? You did, but he isn't following you. He's just in the same time groove. I remember seeing this man in a deli, and nearly ran into him, in fact. Then he is opposite to me on the subway, and I know he will get off at my stop, which is Franklin Street, and he did. Nothing more to it than that. I'm thinking about New Mexico and come around a corner, and there is a New Mexico license plate, New Mexico, land of enchantment. Well, some of my students became quite paranoid and said people were following them and that everything was talking to them and everything had meaning. I said, of course it has meaning. But it was too much for some of them. One of them heard voices saying that I was the B666 or some such nonsense for that, and he had to kill me. Well, he later found Jesus, or Jesus found him. I don't know which, but I got a note from him. Also, you can alter your surroundings by altering your point of observation. And that is an act of magic that is performed by every artist. You can't learn anything, you can't teach anybody anything they don't know already on some level. And you can't show anyone anything they haven't already seen. He just won't see it. Of course, there are people that just don't want to see. There's always the danger of seeing more than you can take. And consider that dedicated professional non-seers are in all positions of power. And non-seeing is an escalating process. The less you see today, the less you will see tomorrow, and so forth. Meanwhile, cats are being boiled alive for food in South Korea. The remaining rainforest is being rapidly destroyed. And there is always, of course, some group brutally oppressing or exterminating another group, leaving a trail of underground terrorist cells, Biafrans, Armenians. Remember the starving Armenians of the 20s? Well, they still maintain a very active terrorist cell. And separatists in all directions, performing their own atrocities and absolutely justified in doing so, at least in their own unwavering opinion. Well, we could stop for some questions at this point. Got some questions, anyone? No questions. Well, in that case, I would like to say something about the techniques of the big lie. L. Ron Hubbard was a master of the big lie, and he had all these rules For there are a number of rules. Always accuse others of doing what you're doing yourself. And here are some techniques for cutting other people's communication lines. Premature acknowledgement. Acknowledge before the person comes to the point. Laugh before he finishes a joke. Under acknowledgement. Like you just couldn't have said anything so stupid and distasteful. Over acknowledgement. Like there's nothing more to say on the subject. Pretend not to understand the most obvious considerations. At crucial moments, create interruptions and diversions. You see, it isn't the truth that hurts. It's a blatant lie, the big lie. Here, writer has spent 7 years on this book, and the pains he has taken are quite apparent to the discerning eye. The critic says, this slovenly potpourri obviously thrown together in a few weeks, you see. That's what gets to people. Pick out the most meticulous, neat, and fastidious person in the office and call him a slob. The person is left smarting and gasping with outrage. And that is precisely what you want to accomplish. You can see the big lie in operation all around you. Well, here's a blatant example of anti-gun propaganda. Laws of the United States, and he was also a security guard with a pistol permit. You see, it's the outrageous misrepresentation that is precisely the point. If your case is weak, stay as far as possible from the facts. No distortion is too outrageous. You remove your case from the court of fact, and then anything goes. That's what Hearst did with his false armistice. Writers sometimes write to make it happen. There's always that question, you know, that people ask you, well, would you write if you were on a desert island? Well, yes, I would try to write in great detail a ship that would come and pick me up. With the captain and everybody, how they happened to get off course, and as precisely as possible. But writers may also write to keep it from happening. If he presents with sufficient precision exactly how it could happen, chances are it won't. Well, he has, in a way, upstaged destiny, which must always present the face of surprised recognition. I mean, if you've already seen it, it's the principle of inoculation with a dead or weakened virus. So, if it's precise enough, it can have that effect. I feel that, for example, that day after in Lawrence, Massachusetts, seems to make it, in my mind, less probable that it will happen. It's already happened.
Lawrence, Kansas?
Yes. The day after. It was a picture about an atomic attack filmed in Lawrence, Kansas, where I live. So I think maybe the film might even keep it from happening or make it less probable. It would just be too pat, you know. Oh, come on, let's have some questions here. Nobody's got any questions about anything? Yes.
Well, it's about writing, projecting, writing from the past, writing from memory. Is what you remember worth writing? Sort of those points of perception which might come up in one. Thanks, Commander Reed.
You speak louder, Dan.
You know how certain points of perception come up in one's memory? Are those the things to write if you're looking backwards?
Well, I guess it's about the only thing. I mean, what did Hemingway say about writing is remembering accurately? But you have nothing but your own total input as subject for writing, and certainly memory is, well, it's perhaps the most important. Because a writer's never going to catch up to the present moment.
So would you say you'd actually have to re-experience these things on some kind of sensory level to be able to write about them accurately?
Well, the more clearly you can reconstruct them in your own mind, the better chance you have of doing the same in the reader's mind. If you can't see it, you can't make the reader see it. See it or experience it as a totality. See it, hear it, touch it, whatever. I think that's sort of what writing is all about, yes.
Is it not possible, though, that a too detailed recall of the past can inhibit your imaginative input into your work?
Well, you've got to be the judge of that, how detailed you want it to be. I think there's definitely a thing as too much detail in writing. A few simple details, the first thing you would see, say a description of a person, the first thing you would notice about them is often better than the most detailed inventories. Yes, that certainly is true. Yes?
William, if I remember correctly, you started writing prose when you were probably older than most people in this class. When you started, did you have false starts? Did you have to do that? I know you read voluminously, and there's a lot of writing education that takes place when you read.
Mm-hmm.
But in terms of developing your prose style and just the ability to stare at yourself coming back off a piece of paper, was there a period of time where it was less mature than what you ended up doing quite quickly, I suppose, with your first works that were published?
Well, I would say that I had less difficulty with the first works, like Junkie, than I had later on. That is to say, I had set myself rather a simple task, so I didn't have so many false starts. But since then, say, since I do nothing else but write, I have innumerable false starts, and good God, I've thrown away 1,000 pages at least, completely destroyed. And yes, I have all, I don't know how many novels that I started and then dropped at some point along the way. They didn't work for some reason. That's part of writing, I think, and some of the most discouraging part of writing is you do an awful lot of bad writing in order to do a little any good writing. Incredibly bad. It'd be very interesting to make a collection of some of the worst writing by good writers, like I've got some here somewhere. Oh yes, like Shakespeare, the end of Titus Andronicus. Let us repair and alter well the state that like events may ne'er it ruinate. Oh my God. But most writers, because of prudently, destroyed that sort of thing. I know I have destroyed an awful lot of writing, at least 1,000 pages. Let's see. Oh, yes, questions. Yes.
So,
Are you recommending wishing or warning against it?
I recommend it. I have, should we say, not an ulterior, but a very obvious motive here. I'd like people to get people experimenting with these machines. First place, I think there's a fortune in it. If someone could just get that little something, you know, that they could patent in the present state, you can't patent it. It's just an electronic device, but I don't know anything about electronics. And I'd like to find someone who could potentiate it in some way.
How big is it?
It's not big at all. It's just about big enough to put a photograph in, two little plates, and then it has a little box. And you plug that into the output, that's all. Into any electrical plug. Now, I don't know who made this thing, but it looks very simple to me. And he gives full instructions in this book for exactly how to make it. There are a number of other experiments, too, in the book, experiments with spirals, and all sorts of dowsing devices and one thing and another. So I recommend it very strongly to your attention. Well, of course, if the thing works at all, it could be extremely dangerous. Obviously, it could be a murder machine. So everyone would have to have one. Protect himself. So I'm hoping that someone will take it further than I have. But I certainly never did anything so stupid as to wish for money. Nor will I help Lem out with his gambling either on the machine. I drew the line at that.
In the modes of perception, you include ideas of
synchronicity. I can't hear you.
In the modes of perception that you were mentioning, do you include the idea of synchronicity?
Oh, good heavens, yes. That's exactly what I'm talking about. I said there is this connection between everybody and his total environment. And scientists tell us that there's no meaning at all in everything we see out there. That's external reality, which can have no relation to human consciousness. Now, it seems to me, as I say, that this is an absolutely indefensible position. But it is the underlying dogma of science. I remember I was talking to a psychoanalyst once, and I said that I'd seen Kirsch's work, and he became hysterical. He said, "No, the person who threw the curse is a hysteric, and the victim is a paranoid." And he thought he'd said something. Well, well, I remember this young, this case was in the papers. It was in Australia, and he did something wrong, and they put a curse on him, which was a snake that would wrap around his ribs and crush him, smother him. Well, they got him to a hospital, and he was in an iron lung for, I think, about 2 weeks, but he did come out. Oh, yes.
You were talking about getting into a pattern of non-seeing where it becomes progressive and gets more and more. How do you get out of a pattern like that?
Well, any descending spiral like that is very difficult to get out of. It's, you know, it's negative feedback. Uh-huh. Yeah, and the less you see, the less you're going to want to see. It becomes more and more painful for you to see anything until finally a point of no return is reached where you just couldn't make the transition.
Did you ever feel like you were in that with your writing, where you just couldn't pick up a pen and write? It was just...
Oh, no, that's an entirely different thing. No, I'm talking about people like the scientists who refuse to see. You could put it right in front of him. One said that he, no matter what evidence was offered, he wouldn't believe it. Well, you're wasting your time with someone like that. But most of the power in this world is vested in the hands of people who do not want to see. In fact, it's very important to them not to see. Very important indeed. I'd like to read this quote from Henry Miller. Who writes the great books? It isn't we who sign our names. What is an artist is a man with antennae who knows how to hook up to currents in the cosmos or whatever. Who is original? Everything that we are doing, everything that we think exists already, and we are only intermediaries. What he's saying then, a writer is an interpreter, a map maker, a transcriber. And he says a writer shouldn't think too much. I think he is thinking there of conscious front brain linear thinking. That is this little tip of our consciousness, which in many of us that's all we have access to, has been compared to the tip of an iceberg which appears above water. And I think it's the job of the writer to show as much as he can of what is below the water. Yes. Yes.
Have you encountered synchronicity in your cut-up experiments?
Oh, God, yes. Well, I've encountered, synchronicity and even prophecy. I was cutting up some material about old man Getty, and it emerged it's a bad thing to sue your own father, and his son did sue him shortly afterwards. And, I've given you that example of coming around a corner, thinking about New Mexico, and there's New Mexico license plate. I've also done experiments with recording in the street, and then, reconstructing just when this and that happens. Sometimes there'll be quite loud noises on there that for some reason or another you didn't hear, or even voices that you can't remember where they came from. That's an extension of the walk exercise. Say, just the simplest form of the exercise is to walk around the block, and in a city is best, wherever there's a considerable input of image, and to make a particular point of remembering exactly what you were thinking and feeling when you saw a sign or read something on a passing truck or someone asked you what time it was or whatever, these intersection points. And that, as I say, can result in people becoming very paranoid simply because they've been going through life with their eyes closed. You ask them, I've asked people, well, they live on a block 10 years. I say, what's on that block? What stores? They won't know in some cases. Well, if you've gone through life with your eyes closed, like, and then suddenly you begin to see, it can be very upsetting and very painful. Even overwhelming, yes.
Achieves the wish, or if it's just a focus point that helps you consolidate your energies?
Both. I don't know. I just wanted to try it. And my impression is that it does work sometimes to some extent. And that's why I'm very anxious to see further experiments. I'd like to see it. There's all kinds of possibilities. Suppose a whole room full of people got together and concentrated on one wish and one in a machine. Or else they could all do it at the same time in different places, synchronizing their watches. We could have the wishing hour on TV. You see, there are all sorts of possibilities to this device, and I'd like to see some of them realized. Yes?
Quite often you hear people say that you only should write what you know, and then on the other hand, that Henry Miller quote saying he was an intermediary, and also Jack Spicer said he felt like a radio. If you believe that, can you consequently write about things you knew absolutely nothing about?
No, because you do know something about them. In other words, suppose I'm writing now about Madagascar, where I've never been, where I probably would go. But I have all sorts of pictures of it in my mind. Well, those are valid. When I get there, I might find that doesn't at all square with the actual place of Madagascar. But like a dream or a fantasy, that is quite valid
material, writing material. It's your totally important dreams. Dreams are a very important part of my input. I get, it's hard to say how much percentage, because I'll get a dream that will lead to all sorts of other areas that I develop, of course, in the waking state. But it came, the original idea, concept, came from that dream.
Percentages, but what amount of dreams do you use in writing your fiction?
Well, I say it's hard to put it in percentage, but I would say that the influence of dreams can be traced throughout fiction. But I'm just talking about now, talking just absolutely straight transposition from a dream, like in Nova Express, Daddy Long Legs looked like Uncle Sam on stilts, that whole section. Well, that came from a dream. I saw this very tall man in a cool room with potted rubber plants, and I knew somehow that this was Daddy Long Legs. And when I woke up, I wrote out the whole passage. Oh, lots of them. The health officer, the whole concept of the health officer in Cities of the Red Night, that was a dream.
From Naked Lunch?
That was not really a dream. I just have to look through some of the, yes, there's quite a lot of dream material in there. I do, yes. Whatever hours. You see, I wake up about 10 times in the course of the average night. I never have slept, I don't ever sleep through. So I get up, maybe have a glass of water. If I remember a dream, I'll write it down. If you don't write them down, you very often forget them. I can lay in bed and go over a dream 10 times and think, you know, if I'm too lazy to get up and it's cold. And I think I've got it, and it can be completely gone in the morning. Other dreams, you won't forget, no matter whether you write them down or not.
Kerouac had a Brinkman's lantern at his bedside. Do you have any particular instruments that you use?
Just a pen or pencil and paper, that's all. I have tried it with a tape recorder. That works pretty well. Well, you have to speak clearly. Often you can't make out what you've said, and sometimes I can't read my own writing in the morning.
Have you ever spoken in any other languages or anything when you woke up and spoke in your tape recorder?
Well, no, but I'll have dreams in other languages. Since I know, I'm a very poor linguist, but I do know a little French, Spanish, and German, and there will be dream encounters. And dream encounters with people who speak languages that I don't understand at all. Or I might understand it, but I don't know the language or have some idea as to what they're saying. Any more questions? You know, I remember that somebody wanted me to write something on the soul of America. An individual soul is sufficiently complex, but the concept of a national soul really appalled me by its vagueness. Of course, everyone, it's only a foreigner that would undertake to write about the soul of another country. Got a lot here about souls. I have a rough definition, but description of a soul as being an electromagnetic field, or perhaps a series of electromagnetic fields that precisely activates a given organism. I wouldn't say that you are your body any more than a pilot is the plane, but that his interests are vitally connected to the plane. Further questions? Yes.
When you're taking notes on your dreams in the morning, you find you have to rewrite them a couple of times. Sometimes I'll be writing out a dream, and then I will think of another dream and midway through the dream. And after I finish that dream, I'll go back and rewrite it because I will remember sections of that segment of the dream. And I'll have to rewrite it a couple of times.
Oh, well, that always happens, I think. You'll write one and then you'll remember, that'll remind you of some more, or might even remind you of a dream you had a previous night that you had forgotten. It just takes, funny how it just takes one little note. Maybe sometimes two words or even one word is all you need, and then suddenly a whole dream section will come back. But they don't come back necessarily in any linear form. How many of you have read An Experiment with Time by Dunn? Oh dear, nobody. Well, he was an English mathematician, physicist, one of the early pioneers in aviation, who published this book in 1924 called An Experiment with Time. Well, he wrote all his dreams down, and he found that they contained material not only from the past, but also from the future, that there were clear references to future events, and he gives a large number of those, a large number of examples. But he did say this, which I found to be true. If you dream, say, of an earthquake or a fire or something like that, you're not dreaming about the event itself, but about the time when you will, in the future time, when you will see it on the television or in the newspapers. And I found that to be true. Well, I think anyone who does write their dreams down long enough will find examples of, clear examples of future events. They may not be very significant or important. I remember once I had a dream in Tangiers about that I saw a wardrobe float by the window. And the next day I was sitting in the Café de Paris, and indeed a wardrobe did float by. The man had a headband, and he was carrying it on his back. You couldn't see the man, but you could just see the wardrobe floating by. No particular significance, but very clear. There was no doubt in my mind that somehow I had slipped ahead and seen that. Yes?
Did you write?
Oh, sure. Yeah. But the.
Once you have recorded an event like that or a dream, and you. Well, how do you then. How much. How do you work it into. Does it come. Does memory bring it back? Or do you premeditate the moment where you enter it into a story?
I don't understand. All right, here I have a dream, and that then I will elaborate on it and incorporate it into a fictional context.
At the time you have it.
Pardon?
You won't store it away necessarily for some future time.
Well, I may use it. Well, I have very extensive dream notes, and sometimes I'll use them immediately. And sometimes I won't have any immediate use for them, but may go back through the book, the notebook, later on, and find a number of dreams that are usable. In fact, that frequently happens. I'm reminded of a dream, and I have to go look for it in my files. Yes?
I find it interesting, too, that when you get a group of people together, that their dreams can start influencing each other, that for a month, there would be evidence that the dream energies would start mingling, and I don't know how you'd know that, except there would be other influences.
Well, yeah, if you can you know, get some kind of sort of cross reference between people, as sometimes they will have the same dream. I mean, a friend of mine was in Ghana collecting snakes, and he and his partner was with him. They were sleeping in the same room, and they both had this same nightmare every night of a black man on stilts standing over them. It was a shared dream. His partner was incidentally killed by a green mamba in Ghana. Oh, yes.
You said that when you write something down with precision, you can make it happen or prevent it from happening. And my experience has been that usually when I write something strong like that, they always happen. So many people have died years or maybe months after I have written about it. What's the trick to prevent it from happening?
Well, I don't know. That's partly the intention of the writer. Whether he wants it to happen. Now, I have sometimes said, this is something I do not want to happen, therefore I will not write it.
Yeah, that's where I'm now. I'm very afraid of writing.
Well, you have to be careful. In other words, like, it's something, these things, if they work at all, they can be very dangerous indeed. yes?
William, not particularly wanting to descend into psychology, but a friend of mine began a series of dreams involving his throat, his health. In fact, he did eventually develop cancer of the thyroid, but before that was ascertained medically, voluminous, gothic, mythic dreams of all sorts, very elaborate, and in any case, the prophecy of dreams became true. He had this problem, then he did or did not pay attention to it. That's not really the question I want to ask, but religious people or people who are involved with shamanic thinking, or even people who follow Joseph Campbell's notions of journey of the hero, they tend to envision these portents as being from protectors or totems or angels, I suppose, if it would be another background that people have. And I wondered what, do you think it's a simpler situation than that? Or on the